This is Femi Kuti, and you are listening to NYC Radio Live.
All right, how you doing, folks? Good? I hope so. You're listening to NYC Radio Live. My name is David Ellenbogen. This was really an amazing show, a great opportunity. I got to sit down with a legend of jazz, Chico Freeman. He's played with everybody. It's ridiculous. Just off the top of my head, we got to talk about playing with Sun Ra, with Dizzy Gillespie, Art Blakey, Elvin Jones, McCoy Tyner, The Temptations, Michael Jackson's, Jack DeJohnette. It's his father, Von Freeman, of course. This guy has lived the life. You know, he is jazz in a sense. That's the family business, and for generations. So we get to talk about all that, and I got the opportunity because he's playing the Dizzy's Club, June 7th and 8th. That's at Jazz at Lincoln Center. That's for your calendar. Also for your calendar, from June 16th onward, the Rubin Museum of Art begins the Year of Sound exhibits. You guys are into sound, right? Sound? Yeah. Oh, so we're going to hear, we'll start this with a track from Chico's tribute to Elvin Jones album, and we'll intersperse a few others, but it's a really amazing discussion. I feel like I learned a lot, and one thing we did not touch on, or we just, you know, after I turned off the mics, he's also a mathematician, and so we're talking about digital music, and he was saying that it's a little complicated, but when they figured out how to use this something called PCM, and it's a way to turn music into binary numbers for digital, there's a way of implying a curve by making smaller and smaller steps of these zeros and ones. And what he told me was that he spoke with one of the guys working for the major companies that developed this. And he had since retired. And he confided in our guest that, yes, they knew that it was harmful, musically harmful, that hearing that this little bit of noise that is in all digital recordings is actually causes kind of stress. So enjoy this digital podcast. I don't know. If you're into vinyl, maybe that will inspire you. Anyway, let's hear some music. If you're hearing some planes and heavy machinery, I'm recording this introduction from lovely Prospect Heights, an important place in music. Within a few blocks, many of the important people in the Brooklyn Raga Massive organization all work here, and so many of the Wednesdays shows that you guys have heard rebroadcast here are just around the corner. So, yeah. All right. Thanks for listening. Enjoy this music from Chico Freeman, and I think you'll get a lot out of the interview. All right. Thanks for listening. Peace. We'll be right back. You are listening to NYC Radio Live. My name is David Ellenbogen. Thrilled to be here with a legend of jazz, Chico Freeman. Thanks for taking the time, man.
Thank you for having me.
Good to be with you. So, I guess right off the bat, I learned that your grandfather was some kind of personality in Chicago, well-known guy, and Louis Armstrong was tight with him, and so what was the story there?
Well, when Louis Armstrong came up from New Orleans to Chicago, prior to him joining the Benny Goodman Band, he lived with my grandfather. They were tight. My grandfather was a policeman. He was one of the first black policemen on the Chicago police force, and also a pianist. So Louis stayed with my grandparents, and my father and his two brothers were kids. So during that time, I think my father was around 6, 7, 8 years old, somewhere in there. But he got a chance to listen to his father and Louis Armstrong play duets in the house, you know, just hanging out.
Wow.
And so Louis stayed there for a while, and then he got the gig with Benny Goodman. And then he was obviously able to be on his own, and he moved
down to
his own
place.
So what
years are we talking?
I don't know those years.
Because, the legend, which I guess is true, of jazz is Louis Armstrong bringing it up from Chicago on a steamboat from New Orleans. But that was him coming up, and I guess playing with King Oliver, stuff like that. So I don't know if this is around that period or
I'm not
later,
sure. I honestly wouldn't want to lie to you, so I don't know.
Yeah, okay. Well, okay, so it's the family business, right?
Well,
from the roots of the thing. And your dad, okay, so your dad's hearing this stuff when he's like 6 or 7, and then obviously he becomes a very important jazz musician playing
Chicago. Him and his two brothers, my Uncle George, who's 90 years old this year.
Guitarist,
and my Uncle Bruz, who's the drummer, who passed away already. And my dad, of course, passed away already.
And from my understanding, those guys became like a rhythm section, or not exactly rhythm section because your dad's saxophone, but they would accompany a lot of the big shot guys.
That's correct. They had a band called the Freeman Brothers, the Heath Brothers in Philadelphia.
Right.
Yeah, there was the Freeman Brothers. And many of the guys that came through Chicago, they were back with the Freeman Brothers band. Was the band that played for them, including Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, just so many of them.
Wow. So Charlie Parker must have been before your time. You must have.
Yes, he was before my time.
Yeah, but you ended up having some associations with Dizzy, right?
Yeah, I played with Dizzy. I went to Cuba with Dizzy. First time I ever went to Cuba.
Wow. Wow. Well, that's another historic kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean. So where were you? Havana?
Yeah.
And, from everything that talked to a few people who met Dizzy, and it sounds like he was generally energized, positive, funny guy.
Yeah.
But I imagine he was just a light in Cuba, right?
He Chano Pozo, that's the big, discovered Chano Pozo in Cuba years before, and he was one of the first guys to... if not the first, I won't say the first because that's
who knows?
I don't know, but surely one of them, if not the first, to collaborate with Cuban musicians in jazz.
Right.
And so he was a force in Cuba because he, in some ways, he introduced jazz to Cuba. From this side of the sea, Caribbean, to that side.
Right.
Because his association with Chano Pozo. It's historic.
And I guess Chano Pozo was the guy that kind of figured out how to match the Cuban drum to a swing thing. Like he figured out how to place that from what I've heard.
You know, that's interesting you say he figured out how to do this. I don't know if things like that, you know, musicians, we don't think like that.
Okay.
You know, we just play. I mean, we hear something, you like it, and you, and maybe that's the process of figuring it out. But okay. It's, when you say it like that, it just sounds a little scientific, laboratorial, you know.
Yeah. Well, on a tangent, speaking of scientific, and I know you have a math background, right?
I do.
So I was going to ask you about music and math.
Okay.
I mean, you know, there's this expression, music is the spontaneous mathematics of the soul. You know, like, for you, how does music line up with math, and how is it totally separate?
Well, first of all, mathematics, we can see the similarities with math and music. I mean, the basic similarities. Mm-hmm. The way notes are, you know, the duration of notes, particularly when we're reading music, you know, we're dealing with fractions, basically. Whole notes, 4/4. Half notes, 1/2. You know, quarter notes, 1/4. It's like fractions. And so we divide time in the basic, the same principle that we use, fractions, and relate that to the division of most everything. There are other more advanced formulas, which I actually wrote a lot of music using mathematical formulas in the early part of my career. But the truth is that mathematics defines life, not only music, but all life. I mean, when I was getting my degree in mathematics, we were given two options. One was to go a practical direction. The other was to go into more esoteric. I chose the esoteric because the formulas and things that we were dealing with, they had not been any use discovered in the practical world yet at that time for a lot of the things that math was figuring out. Mm-hmm. And I found that to be more interesting, you know. So we were dealing with infinite series and things far into the future. But the space program, for example, they tried to recruit me, or I should say, they tried to recruit me for the NASA, you know, out of college. And I considered it to go down there and work, you know, the mathematics on the space program. I declined. But at that time, that's what they had figured out, how to make practical application and how to use the math, this esoteric math. But the math was so far ahead of even what the space program was doing. Now today, computers and so many other things that wasn't happening then were using some of the formulas that I was working on back then. And so now math is still far ahead. So basically, the idea is that math sort of blazes the trail that we follow until we can find uses that we, you know, practical uses for mathematics. So, and then the other thing is, which is quite interesting, math, I say it defines everything. You look at your houses, anything. I mean, it's all mathematically, they're all mathematical principles involved. From travel to the building, architecture, everything. It's just we found ways to use math. And it mixes it with creativity. So, you know, some of the beautiful designs of architecture, these things, you know, I mean, it can be explained so mathematically. So even if something comes up creatively, that maybe the artist is not thinking mathematics at all. Mathematics can look at it and backwards it, you know, define it mathematically. There's a book called the Schillinger System of Composition. And in that book, it's all about mathematics and music. I studied that book. And one of the interesting things is at the end of the book, he takes simple pop music and things at that time and shows how his book actually defines the mathematical principles that have already existed in very simple bass pop music. So,
yeah, I feel like I heard that a lot of people were using that, if I remember correctly, like even the Tin Pan Alley guys, unless I'm confusing with something
else. I honestly don't know what the Tin Pan Alley guys did, but it's possible. I mean,
yeah. So I'd like to hear a little more about these compositions that you were doing back in the day based on mathematical principles.
Well, I actually learned, I was introduced to the book by Muhar Richard Abrams of the AACM. And he was one that introduced me. And so I studied with him. He basically taught the book and used the book in his class of composition. And so that's how that was my beginning with it. And many of the formulas and principles laid out in the book, which if I go into detail, that's kind of boring, but, you know, but many of the principles laid out in the book, we actually did in class. And so, you know, I learned that. So I continue to carry on with those principles. Right. And some of my earlier compositions, a lot that were written with those principles in mind.
Right.
And other things. And then, of course, I developed some of my own, you know, but since I was a mathematician anyway, you know, that's the thing. Everything is relative. That's that whole thing with Einstein, the theory of relativity. But everything is relative. So you can take one thing and relate it in a certain way and take something else and, you know, and move it around in a relative manner and get a different result.
Well, have you found that sometimes something that is very elegant mathematically might not sound so great?
Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you something. Muhal and I, we had an interesting thing. In order to open your ears, you could write. I have actually written compositions and based on mathematical principles, and not necessarily with oral principles. You know, just, you know, Anthony Braxton used to do all kind of mathematical things, for example, and Muhal would say, well, okay, what you have to do is if you write it, you have to listen to it. You have to commit to that the math is correct and that whatever sounds comes out, it may be most people, what they think sounds good is usually things they've already heard.
Right.
Are usually things that they've already heard. So when something doesn't sound good to you, at least upon first hearing, it's because you never really heard it before. So you would have to discipline yourself and listen to it over and over again. Now, after repeated listenings, most times or a lot of times, your ear starts to adjust. And all of a sudden, you start to hear this. Mm-hmm. And so when I would write a song, I would do two things. I'd give it what I would call objective listening and subjective. The objective one, I would force myself, I play it over and over again, you know, even if I didn't like it or thought I didn't like it. And eventually, I'd start to hear it, and it became something that I actually kind of liked. The subjective hearing was I would take that and immediately change what I didn't like. You know, I'd alter a note or whatever, right, or something, you know, that, you know, and that was subjective because but it was always based on clearly what I was already used to.
Right.
So sometimes I'd end up with two compositions. One that was, but then my ear started to expand, and I began to embrace sounds that heretofore I wasn't happy with.
Wow!
So that was an interesting process that I used to use.
Yeah. Well, this sounds like some more Chicago stuff in that, like, Sun Ra was there, and this whole.
He's exactly the name I was thinking about just now. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, this whole you're playing what you know, play what you don't know,
exactly,
kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, both you and your father play with Sun Ra. Maybe, I mean, these guys now and today, they're like icons, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we're very lucky to be around people like you who've actually been close and worked with them. So I don't know what came to mind about him and what could you share about him as a person and a musician, not just an image and icon.
Well, he was a special person. There are many stories that abound about Sun Ra and various things. Sun Ra always said he wasn't from this planet.
Right.
He was from Saturn. And I don't think it was a total show for him, you know. But you know, his music was, during that time particularly, he was a pioneer, and his music wasn't, a lot of things he did and played were unfamiliar,
sure,
to the average ear. And my dad played with him In fact, funny thing, Arthur Hoyle, trumpet player in Chicago, I was just playing in Chicago. He came to see me, and he played in Sunrise Band with my dad, so he's legendary in Chicago. And Burgess Gardner, Vincent Gardner's son, he was Vincent, the trombone player, he plays at the Lincoln Center in the band. He's from Chicago, and his father, Burgess, they also played with my dad. I played with Sun Ra when the funny thing, my dad played with Sun Ra when Sun Ra was in Chicago, but I played with Sun Ra here in New York.
In the East Village.
Well, here in New York, but okay. I should say the East Coast. He was living in Philadelphia at the time, okay. So I used to go to Philadelphia to rehearse and everything.
All right.
But when I say here, because there used
to be that gig at Slugs or something.
Yeah, no, I wasn't here then. I'm too young for that.
Okay, that was earlier. Okay.
Yeah. But I played with Sun Ra here, so
okay.
Continue that. So I had the opportunity. I met those guys when I was young, very young.
Mm-hmm.
Like Marshall, right. Holland, and Pat Patrick, and John Gilmore, and everything.
Right.
Then I got to play with all of them here, you know. So and Sun Ra. And one thing Sun Ra did, which was quite interesting, I went to Philadelphia to rehearse. And I think I had to stay there. We rehearsed like 2 or 3 days. So I didn't, I stayed there. Mm-hmm. And anyway, so we were rehearsing. And Sun Ra pulls out his book. This is the very first time I'm rehearsing with him. First time I've ever, you know, been in a band with him. So the music stands are there. And he's got the music in front. So the first thing I notice is that we're reading the charts. I am anyway. And some of the younger players. Ahmed Abdullah, I remember him being there. And so we're reading. Sun Ra's counting off, and we're reading and playing the music. And I just happen to look down. I'm looking at Marshall and John and Pat and those guys, you know, the original guys in the band. And they're playing the charts, and they're not reading the charts. They're not reading at all. It's all by memory. And I realized how long they had been with him just in that moment. So I was like, wow. And they're playing it perfectly and stuff. And, you know, we're really working hard to read all this stuff, right? And so we rehearsed for 2 or 3 days, reading all this music and everything. Then after the first rehearsal, Sun Ra, everybody leaves. Sun Ra asked me to stay. And he takes me into this room. And in this room, he's got tapes. I mean, just tapes all over the wall. You know, back then, you know, analog tapes, reel to reels, and yeah. And he had cassettes, and he starts playing music for me. Even old vinyl, you know those 78s and stuff. He's playing it, and I'm totally amazed the music he played for me. And this was all him, his music, and various recordings of him, live and otherwise. And I heard music, I thought, wow, that sounded like Miles, but this was before Miles. And I heard other things, and so I started to hear how many people had been influenced by Sun Ra, you know, in so many different ways. And the music was awesome. It was like listening to Duke Ellington or something. When I say listening to Duke Ellington, I don't mean the same music, but, you know, the massive amount of productivity that he had. When I think of the most prolific composer that I know of in American music is Duke Ellington. You know, he's the most prolific. Mm-hmm. He wrote the most music of anybody. And but his music did get out, you know what I mean?
It got out.
But here's Sun Ra playing all of this music, and he wrote all of this music and record. And I'm really realizing how prolific he was. But nobody heard this. This was like music that wasn't disseminated in the same way. So this was quite amazing to me. And then that's when I really realized his genius and who he was and what he had contributed. And a lot of people didn't know. But the people there knew. Like, that's what I realized. I understood he had the same magnetism in the same way as Duke Ellington had with his guy, with Johnny Hodges and Harry Carney and all those guys that stayed with him for years and years and never and didn't want to leave ever. You know, and I wondered, you know, you wonder why were they were committed to the music that he wrote. They loved that music and they stayed there for that, many of them for that main reason. Then I realized there was a similar thing happening with Sun Ra, John Gilmore and Pat Patrick and, you know, Marshall Allen, that all of this music that I heard from Sun Ra, I could understand because it was amazing what I heard.
Yeah. I mean, I guess there is something of being like, ahead of your time or before your time, right?
Yeah.
Like, because his stuff is like now it's emerging as the more influential thing in a sense. I mean, because you hear, particularly through John Gilmore influencing John Coltrane, and then that's it, you know.
But you know, John Coltrane and my Uncle George were tight. They played together with John Coltrane after Earl Bostic and stuff. My uncle, when he first came to New York from Chicago, him and John Coltrane were tight, hanging out and playing together.
Mm.
And he was playing alto then.
Okay. Yeah.
So I found that out just recently, few days ago. We did an interview in Chicago, and this came out in the interview. I was like, wow. I thought I knew. I know a lot about my family, but this one was a new. This one was a surprise.
So Chicago's an interesting town because, on one hand you had the Sun Ra influence and the AACM scene, which I'd like to learn a little bit more about, but then you also had the experience of kind of playing with the original Chicago blues guy, like Memphis Slim. That's
Buddy Guy, Junior Wells.
Okay, you got with those guys too. Wow. So that's the other. That's another side of the coin, right? I mean, it's almost.
Chicago's the home of the urban blues,
right? And you got a taste of that real.
Well, if you live in Chicago, and you're a musician, and you want to be a good, you usually have to do that. Mm-hmm. Not only blues, but certain R&B things. I mean, I got to play with Curtis Mayfield and the Impressions and stuff like that when I first, the Dells, that side as well, and that blues, because the blues side is, there's a blues scene in Chicago.
Right.
And you have to play the blues. I mean, that's Chicago.
Yeah. Do you think, I've heard this kind of quote from Charlie Parker where he said, if we lose the blues, we lose everything. Like, do you feel that having that, being rooted in that way, well, is that important? Like, I mean, can a musician let go of that side and only be on the free side, or do you feel that having that connection is important?
Clearly, a musician can let it go and only be on the free side, but I mean, in my opinion, he's limited. If he or she does that, they are limited. That connection to the blues, I do believe it's extremely important. It's the blues is almost like mathematics in a different kind of way. I mean, it's the folk music of America, particularly of Black America, mm-hmm. but it's the folk music of America, modern, this America. And prior to the Native Americans. And one of the things when I went to Europe, one of the things I was interested in was to, I know what jazz does. Jazz is music of self-expression. And I know what it means to me and to people I know, it's about in terms of what I was reflecting in our lives or how it reflects our lives, and this expression and how important it is. So one of the things I wanted to see was people who live in different cultures, how they express themselves or what that music means in relationship to their life and their culture. And that was one of the things I was very interested. So I got an opportunity to play with gypsies and in Bulgaria, Hungary, Spain, the flamenco gypsies and all kind of things in Greece. That music there and their folk, and I found their folk music. You go to hear people's folk music, the Ganawan musicians, in different places. And how does that relate to their lifestyles or what was their lifestyles at the time that music was, first created or the history of that? Like Irish folk songs, all of that is relative. So one of the things I learned that in Spain, the gypsies, flamenco music, is comparable to the blues, to our blues, in America. And the real flamenco musicians are gypsies. Even though I had the opportunity, you ever heard of Paco de Lucia?
Of course.
I had the great opportunity of playing with him. Incredible.
Wow.
But I also had the opportunity with Arthur Blythe and Don Pullen. We went to a gypsy place and stayed there till the next day, playing all night long. Wow. Until like the next day at noon or 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And these were the blues players, like the blues players in the South, mm-hmm. you know, down there, or the, you know, this experience and that. And I understood that and how it related to, and I began to be, it began to be revealed to me how that music and how it connected to the life, to their life and the life that they were living and leading relative to the society, the Spanish society, and all those other things that we have and music speaks to.
Mm. Yeah, you know, there's one interesting thing, like the gypsy thing and the blues thing, and a lot of the kind of transcendent folk musics is that the interactivity with the audience. Like there's, in each of those groups, the audience will always have something that they'll yell back to the musicians. You know, I found that to be the case. Wow. So were you, I mean, also the dances must help. Like if you're trying to get into a Bulgarian rhythm or something like that, I would imagine that might be a door into how all that music operates.
It shows another part of the culture.
Yeah.
And how the music, how people relate to the music, because, which is kind of interesting, I would say. People, because dance is visual, and people look at dancers. Sometimes people think that dance informs the music, and you know, in all music, dance is important. I mean, the most popular music is music that people feel they can dance to, and even in jazz. I mean, Monco was talking about that in this interview. Like when they had to play, they had to make sure people danced.
Right.
They played for these dances, and if you didn't make the people dance, you know, and even like Lionel Hampton and those guys, they, you know, he was with this, he was swinging, and people danced to that music and going crazy. It wasn't until Charlie Parker that people somehow became attracted to just sitting and listening.
Yeah,
you know, without dance, the music still swung.
Right,
but it was more. I don't want to say intellectual. I really don't want to use that word,
yeah.
But. It was more cerebral in a way, you know,
right.
I mean, it was more melodically intricate.
Yeah.
So people actually had, felt more like they wanted to sit and listen to it than to move,
right.
than to move their bodies to it.
Yeah.
They pat their foot,
right.
But it was more up in their head. Because melody, it connects with your mind.
Sure.
Harmony is like your emotions, and your heart. And rhythm is your body, physical. So, and these three elements of music usually connects with one or more of these at any given time.
Right.
So the dance music part, when you see how people dance, so people, when they watch people dance, sometimes the music is secondary to them.
Sure.
They, you know, when you think of all these dances and, you know, popular music, R&B, funk, whatever,
right.
You see how people move. But the reason that people move the way they move is actually based on the rhythms that the music projects. Where the accents lie, it's the music that generates the movement,
right.
from people, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that was very interesting. It's like when I went to Greece and you see, you know, that Greek dancing, almost like falling off a log kind of thing that they do. And I was wondering, they would be playing, and it was interesting to me that the way they moved their bodies didn't seem so connected to the rhythm of what the music was playing. The music was actually, they played this clarino, like a clarinet,
okay.
and it's very technical. You know, this Bulgarian stuff like that. And the Greeks are dancing like this, you know, like Zorba, you know.
Right, right.
And I'm like, yeah, they're not really in the beat with the, you know. But it was interesting that that's how they expressed themselves. And that was something that was very revealing to me in my travels during that.
Yeah. Wow. What a journey. Wow. Okay. So, yeah. Can you tell me a little bit, like, about that AACM scene? Because I don't really understand. It was a real school. It was school with classes. Or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, when I came for my journey in the AACM started in college, actually. There was a guy named Fred Anderson who lived in Evanston. I went to Northwestern University, and a pianist by the name of Steve Colson. I think, okay, Steve Colson, he called himself. And we put a band together in school called The Life and Death Situation. And we were playing. And he was heavily influenced by Andrew Hill and Cecil Taylor.
Okay,
you know, but and I don't know, we were playing somewhere on the campus and we met a guy named Fred Anderson. And he introduced us to a guy named Billy Brimfield. Billy Brimfield's a trumpet player. Fred just sort of took us under our wing. He invited us to come to his house. And his son, Gene Anderson, played drums. But we would go to his house, and Fred just became kind of like a mentor. Fred played pretty, I don't want to use the word avant-garde, but he was out there, you know. And as experimental, let's say, as he was playing, all he did was put Charlie Parker records on for us.
Mm.
We go to his house and he just played Bird all the time. He didn't play any of the then, you know, Ornette Coleman or then experimental Cecil Taylor. He didn't play it. He played only Charlie Parker for the most part. And he just sort of turned us on to Bird like this and a few others like Gene Ammons and, you know, other saxophone players, mostly Charlie Parker. And his wife, sometimes she would cook dinner for us because we'd be there. And one night we spent the night at his house, slept on the floor. So we just, we would go there and he would just, I don't know, he just filled our heads with a lot of information. And so we sort of started a chapter of the AAC in Evanston. We just did that because he was in the AAC and he had been in the AAC. Mm-hmm. I was. But he lived in Evanston and Muha was in Chicago on the south side. So we did that. But before that, we didn't know about Muha. So this was all Fred. And then when we were about to graduate, he gave us Muha's phone number and information. So when I got to Chicago after graduating school, called up Muha, and he invited me and Agdego K. and Iqua Colson, who's now Agdego K.'s wife, invited us to go to come to the A's because he had a building, Child City. Pete Cozy, who guitar player who played with Miles Davis, his mother had a daycare center. And it was a building where they, you know, where the children, she did daycare for children. And we used that building, Muha used that building for his, for AACM activities. It was sort of like she allowed that to happen. We did concerts there, and when the kids weren't there, you know, we had the rooms for classes and everything. So it was literally like a real school. Mm-hmm. And so went down there and walked into his class, composition class, and he was teaching composition. And I stayed. And he and I became close. And later, I started going to his house, you know, aside from the AACM activities school. And he started turning me on to even people before Charlie Parker, like James B. Johnson. Mm. And, I mean, really, he went way back. And I learned a lot. He had records and things like that. And I was like, I learned about these people I'd never heard of in my life. But they were like, I was like, wow. Sid Catlett and, you know, just all kind of people. So I got a great education from Muha. And it was a special education because it was some of the great African-American musicians from, you know, days before. Then add to that my dad and my uncle and, you know, my uncles and listening to the rehearsals and stuff that they did. And played. I mean, I met people like Andrew Hill, and because Andrew lived in Chicago, and Ahmad Jamal, and other people. And so music was all around me.
Right.
Yeah. But when I was in high school, all I wanted to do was sing like the Temptations.
Right. Well, yeah. You got into that thing, right?
I mean, you got those gigs.
Yeah,
I sang. I did a lot of singing. I was in singing groups. And did that. And then even when I got out of college, I joined the Earth, Wind & Fire for a while and played with them.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the great musicians in Chicago were in that band. Oscar Brashear, who later moved to California, became one of the premier studio musicians out there. He's on a lot of, you know, a lot of times people don't know what great musicians are on these pop recordings because they never listed the names of the musicians
on these
famous groups and artists, the singers mostly. You never know who's playing. Right. It wasn't until later that they started putting musicians' name on there. That's how people found out that Michael Brecker was on a lot of, you know, commercial records because they started putting the names of people, the musicians on there. But prior to that, they didn't do that. And there were some of the, I mean, you just, the Motown. the Funk Brothers, right?
Right.
They were all jazz musicians. Mm-hmm. Nobody really knew about them until after Motown became iconic.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Right. So is that was kind of a dream come true in a way for you to play with all these the highest level?
I was playing with great musicians, really great musicians, and the Regal Theater, which is sort of like the Apollo of Chicago. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean,
yeah.
We call that part of the Chitlin Circuit. Mm-hmm. For black musicians and artists in general,
yeah.
You know, to travel there. And my dad had played I saw him play the Regal all the time, but it used to be Duke Ellington played the Regal, Count Basie played the Regal, you know, back then. Then the music changed, and then R&B and pop, and then you got people like, you know, the Dells and the Spinners and others, you know, the blues mm-hmm. guys, B.B. King, Albert King, and... you know, just all the Motown, the whole Motown review would go there. So that was my generation. So I played with a lot of those guys. And I was playing with some of the great, really good musicians in Chicago because the bands that we had there to back up these guys. So I played with the Temptations, the Isley Brothers, the Four Tops, the Dells, the Spinners, you know, Curtis wow. Mayfield, Lou Rawls, who's from Chicago, singer, you know, blues singer. He had a pop hit. And... A lot of people I got to play with. And one of the guys that was really helped me, because when I first started, I was green. Mm-hmm. And was a guy named Donald Myrick. We called him Hipmo. And he, at the same time the AACM was going on, there was another group called the Pharaohs. Phil Coran had this, he was kind of like, he and Muhal started out together trying to do something. Then they kind of split. They had different ideas of which way they wanted to go. And so they ended up starting their own, Muhal with the AACM and Phil Coran with the Pharaohs. And Hipmo had been in that particular group. And but he and I played some of those blues clubs together. And actually the first time I got my first gig playing with one of, in that kind of R&B arena, I was the first time I was green. And Hipmo was sitting next to me. He was playing alto and I was playing tenor. And I hadn't had any experience in this yet. And he was very helpful to me. He helped make sure I was in the right place and everything. And we did so well that after that, they were called. We got to be on the first call. Mm. And they called both of us. So we had an opportunity. We played together a lot. So we became very close. And he's the one who started the Phoenix Horns, which is the... He also played with Earth, Wind & Fire, but he played with Earth, Wind & Fire after Maurice White went to L.A. And so the Phoenix Horn, that horn section,
okay.
All those guys, Romney, Michael Davis, Louis Satterfield, Michael Harris, and Hipmo, Donald Myron, were all Chicago guys, musicians, oh, wow. And they... Hipmo started the Phoenix Horns, and that was the Phoenix Horns. They played on Phil Collins's records, so every time Hipmo came to town, when he came, he went to L.A., I went to New York.
Right.
I played with Elvin Jones. He joined Earth, Wind & Fire, but mm-hmm. we both had played with Earth, Wind & Fire in Chicago when Maurice White
right.
first started the band, which is after Maurice White left Ramsey Lewis,
wow.
the Ramsey Lewis trio. So that's out of that little historical thing.
Right. So it can't be the worst thing to tell, like, an aspiring girlfriend that you're going to go play with Earth, Wind & Fire that night, right? I mean, that's got to be a...
Yeah, well, I wasn't thinking about that.
Oh, you weren't thinking about that?
No, no.
Wow. Yeah. So that's incredible. So you had the deepest of the blues. Because, I mean, from my understanding, Memphis Slim, I mean, he was on Big Bill Brunzi records and stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's...
Yeah,
that's it. That's where it
started.
Well,
my dad played with all those blues guys too. So mm-hmm. You know, all of them. So Memphis and my dad had played together already. So when I got there and played with him, so I was kind of like, that was very cool. I played with him also. Another place I played with him was in London, at the at Ronnie Scott's.
Mm-hmm.
So that was interesting.
Right. And did you find? So yeah. I mean, well, I was just thinking. You know, my original thought was just like, I mean, in Chicago, you're getting. This AACM and the Sun Ra, you know, this kind of
experimental music.
We
called it experimental music, yeah.
And then you're getting the deep, deep as the blues with Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters around and all that. And then you're getting to play with Earth, Wind & Fire and Temptations. I mean, that's it. I mean, that's American.
I play fusion. There was a band called Street Dancer. Uh-huh. I joined Kenny Elliott, a great drummer. He's living in L.A. now, but we were in Chicago and together, and we joined this band, Street Dancer. Let's see, Kestutis Stankowski, I think is his name. His name was. He was the bass player and he was the leader of the band. Mm-hmm. And this was all fusion stuff, playing nines and sevens and
right.
You know that fusion kind of
yep. Electric basses
and all of that. So that was an experience. But yeah, so Chicago has a whole array of musical genres that
And also, did the at the AACM, was there a kind of spoken political thing? Was that something that was spoken of, or it was just implied in the music? You know,
with the
AACM music. Uh-huh. You know, that the music that came out of there. I mean, it feels like it's a statement. It feels like it's
there were a lot of political things going on at the time. So yes. Many musicians chose to express their political views at the time. I mean, you know, we're dealing with civil rights at that time. Mm-hmm. We're dealing with Martin Luther King and cattle prods being put on him. All the protests and marches that Martin Luther King did in the South and everything, they put hoses on them, you know, water hoses.
Right.
But it wasn't until he came to Chicago that they actually put a cattle prod. They used cattle prods.
Wow.
So... Yeah, we spoke about that, and then there was a lot of political stuff going on, and the music did reflect it. I mean, it can't not,
mm-hmm.
because, I mean, that's what I was talking about, self-expression. If it's really about self-expression and these things are happening in your life, how can you not express them, or how can they not be connected?
And one thing that I try to wrap my head around a little bit is that when I hear, you know, Ornette in early 1960s or whatever, or Cecil Taylor or these guys, it seems to me to be connected with, as you're saying, everything that's going on, right? You know, everything coming to a boil, you know, and civil rights movement and radical movement starting. And then now, when I hear people say, oh, I play free, and it sounds very similar to that, I kind of scratch my head and I'm like, how is that free? If it sounds like 40 years ago. Like, I don't know. What are your thoughts on the way this kind of music has become codified?
Well, I don't think it has become codified. I think what happened is that even back then, they tried to call the... There were different labels for the music. Mm-hmm. They had avant-garde. They had free, they called it free music. In fact, that label, I always rejected that. You play free music. And I said, no, I get paid.
Right.
But that was a name that many musicians, that was a moniker that a lot of musicians that were playing. I preferred experimental music. Mm-hmm. Because there were, I believe in freedom through discipline. And the freedom is just being, in my opinion, what the word freedom is mean. The more you're able to do something with ease and the better you become, it gives you a certain freedom to express yourself. And that, to me, Charlie Parker, by that definition, Charlie Parker played free music.
Right.
You know, he practiced for 2-3 years, 8 to 10 hours a day, every day. That diligence and dedication gave him the ability to play the way he played. That discipline, that's what, and it gave him the ability to freely express himself. So that's what free means to me. Not this being able to willy-nilly and just, you know, do this. So what we were doing, and we were playing experimental music. We were experimenting with different, and that's what I looked at my music. I experimented with forms. There was always structure, you know. I don't believe anything is completely free like that, because there's always some rules that bind you, some rules that govern you on some level, somewhere. I mean, just living on this planet, the rule of gravity.
Can't beat that one, yeah.
Yeah, so So structure. So I experimented with structure. I experimented with harmony. You know, I experimented with melody and mixed them all together. And it was all experimental. That's what Muhal, that's what we were always doing. And like I said, you know, with mathematical principles, there are many things that you can, elements that you can bring into. Like I said, in this case, it was like science, you know, trying to figure out how to do this, you know, and or if I do this, what happens when I do that? And so that's just experimental. So that, I believe that means, I believe Sun Ra, myself, AACM, Pharaohs, all, you know, Cecil Taylor, you know, Ornette, sometimes they came up with systems. Arnett's harmonic system, you know, and Cecil Taylor's structure. He did a record called Unit Structures. And I realized later, the writer Gary Giddens, who I have great respect for, was one of the first writers to understand what Cecil Taylor was doing, wow, to hear it and understand it. And it took him some time, you know, to listen, but then he found out that things Cecil Taylor was playing, they weren't free at all. Cecil Taylor practiced, and he came up with these really crazy-ass, you know, melodic structures and rhythmic structures. But he could repeat them.
Right.
He could write them down. They were not complete, you know, yeah, totally. They were. He had songs that did, and if you listen, there's patterns and things there. And so, you know, that's what I think this, you know, any intelligent person or anybody that's, wants to be good at something, be the best at something. You know, look at any sports figure, from Dr. J, Elgin Baylor to Michael Jordan, you know, now to Kobe and LeBron James. You can see a lineage of connection with how their bodies move and what they do and how they attack the basket, all of these things. And when they became creative and tried to do something different and experimented, you know. Now we got a whole, when you say codify, now we have a whole, they have the slam dunk contest, which used to be just, that was just a thing.
Right.
You know, but now it's a whole.
Yep.
You know? So, I mean, yeah, that's how things develop. And
right. But do you feel if Charlie Parker was born in 1980,
mm-hmm,
would he be playing jazz? Would he be playing bebop?
I mean, okay, that's speculation, obviously.
Yeah, sure.
But I would speculate that what was in him that drove him was in him.
Yeah.
And if that remained in him, I'm not sure whether it would be jazz. I think probably because other things, I would guess that other things might be too limiting for him.
Mm-hmm.
But if he came up, and his, let's say he was raised in a hip-hop environment, let's say, for example, I think he would be just as creative as he was, but not necessarily in jazz. I don't know what it would be.
Yeah.
Maybe in jazz, and I think his environment has everything to do with what we do.
Since we established you play with so many people, and it's important for me to just document some of the words or intentions of the master. So, Elvin Jones, what would you get out of that? Did he say things? Did he?
Oh, he was great, man. I loved him, and I feel like he really cared about me as well. He gave me my first recording, mm-hmm, and I did a record, Beyond the Rain. But how I got that recording is funny. I'm playing in his band, and we're on an airplane flying from Boston, I believe it was, to Los Angeles, and I'm sitting there, and I my seat was actually next to his. We were on the plane, and I think I had the window seat, and he had the aisle seat, if I remember correctly. And we're there, and I'm quiet, you know. And then he just says to me, he says, "You want to make a record, Gigo?" He had this voice, and I said to him, "Oh, sure, sure." And I'm thinking, "Wow, he's going to make a record, and he's." I'm going to be on the record. And he says, I said, "Yeah, sure, Elvin." And then he says, "What you want to play?" I said, "Whatever you want to play, just, you know, anything you want to play, give me music." He says, "I don't know, what do you want to play? It's your record, man." And that's how I found out that I got a record, you know, that he did that. Now I'm on my way to, I said, "Well, when is this going to happen?" He said, "Well, as soon as we landed in LA at the airport, Lester's going to pick us up and we're going to the studio." I was like, I haven't written any music. I haven't, you know, I wasn't prepared for that. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, I was like, oh, okay. So then he says, oh, you want on the record? And I thought, okay, the band's flying in, you know, so I, you know, it's probably going to be this band. He says, I said, well, McCoy Tyner, can I get him on piano? He says, all right, I'll call him. So I'm like, oh, man. So he called McCoy. When we landed, he called McCoy, and McCoy was somewhere that he couldn't get there, so he said, couldn't do it. So he said, McCoy can't make it. Who else you want? So I said, well, how about Hilton Ruiz? I had heard Hilton before. And they called Hilton, and Hilton was free, so they flew him out there. And that was my first record.
Wow.
He said, oh, you want on bass? I said, well, we can use Junie. Junie Booth was was already in the band playing. Uh-huh. So I thought that would keep that because Elvin seemed to like him. So that's how that happened.
Wow, amazing.
Yeah. So, I was with him for a long. And then he recorded two or three albums with me when I was the leader. And,
right.
And I learned a lot from him, man, just sitting there listening to him play. There's a song that I play called, that I wrote for him called Elvin. And I'm playing, and it's a funny thing because the first part of the song is a bass line with this kind of conjugular, I don't know if that's a word.
Okay, conjugular.
You know, all
now it is.
Jagged kind of melody.
Okay.
And, but the bridge goes to this. That's the rhythm, and I wrote the ba-dee-da over this, you know. And sometimes jazz musicians, they want to just already do different things around something. And I said, no. This rhythm. You should just this makes it different from the, you know, to be different from the A. So play it like that. And I said, because I took that rhythm right out. It was one of the rhythms that Elvin used to play. I used to have him play. Yeah. And so I took that rhythm and used it as the basis for the bridge. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he kind of seemed, what he brought into the drums, I guess him and Blakey too, like they brought in this polyrhythmic kind of African thing.
Elvin had, and the triplets. Mm-hmm. Elvin's triplets up until that time, nobody really used triplets like he did, you know. But you're right, there's that raw, and he always played on the backside of the beat, which for me today as young players, there are always different schools of guys that guys follow, you know. It's like the Lester Young school and the Coleman Hawkins school for saxophone.
Sure.
Dexter Gordon, and I mean, we're always influenced by both sides, but then sometimes you hear some guys lean a little bit towards one or the other. Lester Young, I'm more or less from that side of it, you know. Sonny Rollins, more or less from the Coleman Hawkins side. Although, sure, Lester Young played a big role in his life. Coltrane, more from the Lester Young side, for example. Mm-hmm. Things like that, you know, and obviously others. So in my time, for the young players that I knew about that came up with me, there was Elvin and Tony Williams. Mm-hmm. And so many drummers went on the Tony Williams side, you know, a lot of them. But Elvin has always been my guy, even before I played with him. And Tony played way on top of the beat, up. Mm.
Right.
He played up, you know, like it almost felt like you're rushing, you know, like it has a certain kind of forward motion.
Sure.
And Elvin, more relaxed. Mm-hmm. It was more relaxed. And I did a little research on my own. And I found out that 90% of the any songs that were big hits in any genre, you know, so you name R&B, like Ray Charles or anybody, really, it was always back.
How about that?
You know, Sly Stone, Aretha Franklin, you name James Brown, you know, it's always, they play more relaxed and on the backside of the beat.
Wow.
And except for maybe, even George Clinton, you know, like Funkadelic, when the funk thing came in, that was really more like right on top of the beat, you know, right in the middle.
Right.
Because it had this kind of thing. But rare, but the most, reggae back. Mm-hmm. And I even found that, except, and even Latin music, in New York, what they call the salsa. That's where the salsa thing happened. But salsa is based on Afro-Cuban music.
Sure.
So salsa is, the guys I met, they all play up. You know, salsa, it's like, again, that kind of playing in front of the beat, almost.
Mm-hmm.
But when I went to Cuba, the Cubans play relaxed and back, on the middle to back. So almost every kind of music I saw that really was popular in any genre, it was always relaxed and back.
Wow. I'm glad to hear that, because I used to get in trouble for being on the backside of beat. Maybe that was just dragging.
Yeah.
I guess there's that.
Well, the thing is, when you say that, playing on the top side of the beat doesn't mean you're supposed to rush it.
Right.
The tempo's not supposed to get faster. And if you play on the backside, that doesn't mean it's supposed to slow down.
Right.
It just means it's you're relaxed. You know. So
right.
I always think, you know what the Autobahn is? In Germany, the Autobahn is a highway, but there's no speed limit.
Right.
So you can go literally as fast as you want to. So I always think of it like driving down the Autobahn in a Cadillac.
Right.
As opposed to driving down the Autobahn in a Volkswagen Bug.
Right.
You know, the bug. You know, you would be like this in a Bug driving 250 miles an hour.
Sure.
Right? You'd be like shaking and you'd be on your guard. But people in a Cadillac, they'd be driving down the same speed, but, you know, they'd be relaxed. You got comfortable seats and car is steady and solid.
Right.
So you know.
I always heard that in like the snare on, especially the Chicago blues stuff, the behind the beat thing.
Yeah. That's Chicago style.
Mm-hmm.
It's relaxed. I just like to refer to it as relaxed. It's more relaxed.
Yeah.
And I found out that Charlie Parker, he played behind the beat. And if you think of everything he did, there's a video on YouTube you can see of Charlie Parker. He's sitting there, and somebody else is there. I forget who the other player might have been. Another saxophone player, I think. Could have been. I don't remember. But Charlie Parker's sitting there, and he's just waiting to play. Then when his turn comes, he starts playing. And his fingers, he kept his fingers on the keys. It almost didn't look like his fingers moved.
Mm-hmm.
Pharoah Saunders is very good at that too. You see, if you watch video, Coltrane too. But Charlie Parker really had it down. His fingers hardly look like they're moving. You can see them press the keys, but they're just, you know, like some players, you see their fingers flying out like in doing.
Sure.
Then all of a sudden he's playing, you know. And all of a sudden, and you're looking at his finger, and you're hearing all this music come out, and his fingers aren't moving. I mean, they're obviously moving, but it's like they're not moving. Wow. And he's like a statue. I said, wow. He's playing all these notes and stuff, and I see that the technique, that's how he's playing all of that. And I saw another video with Coltrane with Stan Getz and Oscar Peterson. And same thing, Coltrane's fingers are just like that. And he's standing like a statue. You know, all this moving around and everything.
Right.
You know, just focused all of that energy into his fingers, you see.
Yeah, now you did your heavy wood shedding period, right? You did.
Yeah. I still do it now. But yes, there was a heavy. Everybody has to do it to some point or other.
Eight hours a day or something like that.
Yeah. I did that.
And you had a system. You were real organized about it. Because I mean, you could practice 8 hours a day and just waste all your time.
That's true. That brings me when my dad told me one day I was practicing, and he's listening. And then he comes up to me and he pulls the horn out of my mouth and shocked me because I'm practicing, and I'm thinking he would be proud.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me, he said, listen, he took the horn out, and he made me sit down, and he put something on tape or tape player, and he said, now listen, I think I was playing Misty or something, practicing Misty or something like that. And he made me listen, and I listened. And then he gave me the horn back, and he told me, not practice. After I finished, he told me to come into the room. And he had recorded me playing before he pulled the horn out of my mouth, and he recorded me after I listened to what he told me to listen to. And he said, what do you like? And I picked, without knowing which, I picked the one that was after I listened to, you know. Mm-hmm. And he said, there's a time to play and there's a time to listen. And he said, because you think practice makes perfect. He said, it's not true. He said, perfect practice makes perfect.
Wow.
So that's a good point you make about you could practice for 8 hours and be wasting your time if you're not practicing the right things.
Wow.
The key is trying to figure out and know what are the things you should be practicing. Mm. So that helped me.
Yeah.
When I went into that heavy wood shedding period to hopefully practice the things.
Yeah. Wow. Cool. Maybe the last, I'm just going to run through the list because I want to know. All right, you work with Michael Jackson?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I worked with him with the Jackson 5.
Back in the day.
Back in the day with the, you know, when it was the...
So he was what? How old was he?
I don't know.
Because, I mean, he started...
I'll
he
take
10,
you back that day.
Yeah,
you
10,
know, that,
10
that,
or 12 or something.
Yeah, whatever it was. 7, 8, 9, 10. Yeah, something like that. Somewhere in there. I don't really remember.
Right, but was
time.
There, I mean... Could you see it? Could you see that? Because I've seen videos of
He was a bad man, bad young man. He wasn't a man then, but he was bad boy then, yeah.
I mean, I saw his, there's a video on YouTube. It's his tryout video for Motown, and he's maybe 8, and he's singing I Got the Feeling of James Brown.
Yeah.
I've
seen that video.
Baby, baby. And he's like, he's a man child. He's like,
he's tough.
He's got everything.
Yeah, he
he's got
tough.
Everything.
And then I worked with him later when he was older, when he was Michael Jackson. You know, mm-hmm. I took two periods. But anyway, yeah.
And did you get to speak with him?
Yeah, a little bit. He was not so much when he was the Jackson 5 because we were, you know, but a little bit later I did. He was a nice guy. He was really a nice guy, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
All the things that. I don't know anything about all that other craziness that you know they said and everything, so I can't speak to that. But I never saw that kind of person.
Yeah. And you were touring with him, or you
I didn't tour. It was just playing in the, you know, when I played in the bands and stuff when it was coming around. You know,
local shows.
Yes.
And. Yeah, I also, like, there's this video of, came out after he died, This Is It, I think.
Yeah.
You saw that?
Yeah.
So there's that moment where he's like, you know, talking about the bass player, he's like, no, play a little more like this, and then he just sings the funkiest thing you've ever heard in your life. I don't know, was there things like...
Well, you see, Michael Jackson, you know, you saw that, that movie, This Is It.
Parts of it, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well, in that movie, the way he danced, I mean, one of his great contributions was his dancing.
Sure.
I mean, he influenced, obviously influenced his sister, Janet. And then you look up and then Madonna and Britney Spears and all these other people, what's his name? I like him. He was with Britney Spears in the Mickey Mouse Club.
Oh, okay, one of these young kids.
Yeah, the guy. He was in a boy band, too.
Justin Timberlake. Yeah, he's got that thing.
All of these guys. So it looked like all of these guys, I mean, the whole dancing thing, Michael influenced everything. And not only them, but look at all the guys who could do the move. But, like, the moonwalk was Michael's, it's like people thought he invented that. Like that was it. But that was done by... Years back, there's the first moonwalk. Just YouTube it.
Yeah,
it wasn't Bojangles. He did one of them, but there was another guy, tap dancer that did it. That did the actual first moonwalk.
Right.
But what we found out is that Michael studied all the dancers from way back. Like Muhal took me back to James P. Johnson and all these people. He did the same thing as it relates to dance. And he studied and studied, and he practiced and practiced. He woodshed it like Charlie Parker did.
Right.
That's why I said, if I don't know that Charlie Parker would have necessarily been a jazz musician, but whatever he would have been, if he had that same thing in him, he would have been the best at it. You know, he would have come out doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how about you worked with some of the great Latin players, Celia Cruz?
Celia Cruz. Yeah, I worked with her. Chucho Valdez. Yeah. You got the
Eddie
name.
Eddie Palmieri.
Yes. Yeah.
Machito.
I was in Machito's band for a couple of years.
Oh, wow.
And Eddie Palmieri, I worked in his band. And then, funny thing, I did a concert at Carnegie Hall. And it was it was Eddie Palmieri and McCoy Tyner. Mm-hmm. And I was in McCoy's band at the time. And so I thought, that's funny. So, Eddie and I laughed about that. But Eddie's a friend. Yeah,
he's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. I played with him and Machito was great too.
Wow.
I met Mario Bauza. Mm-hmm. And so I got to know some of the Cuban history. You know.
Right.
Those guys, you know. And I sat in the chair because Charlie Parker played with Machito. And Hubert Laws.
Right. So you got to sit in Charlie Parker's seat, and you got to sit in John Coltrane's seat, right?
With Elvin. Oh yeah.
Wow. I mean, that's quite a nice little knighting or whatever. I mean, to get the nod from those guys.
Yeah. I got to sit in John Gilmore's seat.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So to speak. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Exciting. So you got this show coming up. What's your current lineup of your band?
It's got Nasheed Waits, who's on drums, whose father was in my band, Freddie Waits.
Okay.
And there's a connection there with Freddie and myself.
Mm-hmm.
The connection with Freddie, it goes even further. You know, I played with Stevie Wonder, right? So,
I didn't know.
But Freddie played with Stevie Wonder. You know the very first record Stevie Wonder put out called Fingertips,
yeah.
Part 2, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
That was recorded live at the Regal in Chicago, the one I told you about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the drummer on that is Freddie Waits.
Wow.
So, here's how things go. Now, obviously, I didn't know that, but Freddie's from Detroit, or was from Detroit, like Elvin. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Right.
So, Freddie Waits, later on, I had no idea, but he and I were going to become very close friends, but I didn't know that then, obviously. And, so Fingertips, one of my favorite, you know, everybody say yeah, 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 you know, yeah, 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 yeah. And and at the Regal Theater, which was going to be a place that I was going to play.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't played there yet because I was a kid listening to that, you know. But Freddie then, when I come to, there's another record that McCoy did called Time for Tyner. And this song on there was called African Village.
Oh, yeah.
And I love this song. And so I bought the record, and I'm looking at the people on there, and Freddie Waits is the drummer on this song. Okay, that's the next time I kind of see Freddie, right? So years later, when I come to New York and everything, and Freddie ends up in my band, you know, playing with me as the leader, and he's in my band. And I take him out. We travel all over. I took him to London. We played. There's videos with us in Spain and all over. And you can see on YouTube. And he and I worked hard. And Freddie had these two boys and his wife and everything. You know, and Freddie had two sons. Excuse me. So I called Freddie for a record date when I was recording with Bruce Lundvall at Warner Brothers, Electric Musician. And Freddie couldn't make the date. He said yes, and we were good. And then he called me to tell me he couldn't make, because his wife had just passed. I mean, this happened in the time period he was supposed to make the mm-hmm. record with me. So he couldn't do it. So I said, okay, of course. And I ended up writing a song for his wife, called Ballad for Hakima. His wife's name was Hakima. And then after I made the record, so I ended up using Billy Hart, I think, and Jack DeJohnette on this record. And, Freddie didn't do it. So then after the record was made, I had a tour in Europe and Spain and Canary Islands. And Freddie, he just lost his wife, but he had these two boys, and he didn't know how he was going to make the tour because he wasn't sure, you know, he didn't have baby.
Right, I said, gonna watch the kids.
Yes, I told him, bring the kids with him. So, we went to Canary Islands together, and he brought Nasheed and his other son, his name's escaping my name. It'll come up. But so I made it possible for him to bring his kids so he could do the tour. Oh. So we were like 2 weeks in the Canary Islands. This gig was like that. And so now his son, Nasheed, is playing with me at Dizzy's.
Wow, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Amazing.
So that's a connection there. And I have Kenny Davis on bass, who's from Chicago. He just finished. He was in Chicago with me this time. Mm-hmm. And I have Anthony Wanzi on piano, again from Chicago. Both Kenny and Anthony were raised by my father.
Literally.
I mean, well, not
okay,
like...
Musically.
Musically,
music.
Yeah. Okay. Literally, musically. Literally, musically.
Literally, musically, yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, Kenny told me, he said that my dad prepared him for his trip, for coming to New York. Mm-hmm. He played with my dad for a year and a half to 2 years. Every day, every week, and Wanzi too. So Anthony, so they're Chicago homeboys. So they're there, and I respect because the plus tet means there can always be different things. Warren Wolf is playing vibes.
Oh wow, nice! And that's June 7th. We said then.
June 7th and 8th.
June 7th and 8th at Dizzy's Club. We'll definitely pump that. So, Stevie Wonder, man. To me, a lot of these people you're talking about, mm-hmm. I expect will be listened to in hundreds of years in the same way that we still listen to Bach or whatever. Like, will people still listen to Sun Ra, I would think, or definitely Coltrane or so, you know. And I don't know. To me, it's like Stevie's like another Bach.
Yeah, he's great, man. Yeah. I mean, he's one of the most, in his genre, and he has a love for jazz too. Mm-hmm. But he's one of the most prolific writers that we have in any genre.
Yeah, and so you got to play with, in what capacity did you get to play with him?
Chicago the Regal Theater.
Oh wow! Okay, so that was when he was young.
But older than Fingertips.
Okay.
And then another place. He came. Where was it? I can't remember. He came because, you know, he used to like to jam and sit in with people and play. And and that happened a few times. He came like Prince. Mm-hmm. You know, he used to do that.
Right.
You know, come and play. Even with jazz musicians, Prince was like that. But yeah, Stevie but I was playing with him someplace. It was one of those Chitlin Circuit places somewhere in the Midwest. I can't remember the exact place.
Right.
Yeah.
So you'd played up and down this Chitlin
I did circuit. I did the Chitlin Circuit
and
with different various bands, you know.
From some things, I don't know much about it, but I heard some people say that, like, sometimes the promoters would just not pay or something. Like, that was a rough thing.
Yeah, it was rough. Yeah, I got a couple of stories. My dad told me a couple. So he played out in a place called Calumet City, right? This was mafia, in Chicago mafia, Al Capone type. Well, later, obviously. And he went to go get the money, and the guy put a 38 on the table and said, "You've been paid." So they had to leave without getting paid. Yeah.
Wow.
Mafia was pretty racist back then. So, yeah, they weren't. But, and my dad, with Sun Ra, this is what I'm telling you. I'm going to tell you why. They used to play Calumet City, and they put them behind, the musicians behind a cage. And black musicians had to play with their eyes looking up at the ceiling because they didn't want them looking at the white girls.
Wow.
And Sun Ra, my dad was playing with Sun Ra in one of those places, and they had to play like that. And then they didn't want to pay them. And there's a whole story, but I won't get into this whole story. But
yeah, there it is. We got a minute.
Yeah. No, I don't know. Yeah. Because it's like it's a mystical story. Like, they were there and playing, and then after this, they wouldn't pay them. Sun Ra went to get paid, and they wouldn't pay them. And plus, they were behind a cage because they didn't want them fraternizing with the women, white women. And they had their eyes like looking. They had to look at the ceilings so as not to look at the right. So Sun Ra told him, "Guys, get your instruments, and we're gonna go out this way." And something happened, or some kind of thing, and they went out. And my father said, he didn't know what was going on. He said, but, you know, when they got in their cars and they were driving, not no money and everything. And look back, there was smoke coming out of the club.
Wow.
And the club had somehow caught fire, and Sun Ra had predicted this or something like that, you know. And my father, he was like, ooh.
Right, right. Well, yeah, there's a lot of those Sun Ra stories.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. That was one of them. My father, he experienced, he told me that.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. Well, on that note,
but you have. I'm sorry, but you have other.
Oh, sure, man. Mingus. You played with Mingus?
Yeah. That was a great one.
All right. So, what was the deal? I mean,
Mingus is sort of the reason I came to New York.
Okay.
He was playing at a place called The Amazing Grace. I remember this, and I came up to sit in. I went up there and I asked him if I could sit in, and he had Don Pullen, Danny Richmond, George Adams, and Jack Walrath.
Yeah.
And so I went in. I was kind of like out of school. I mean, I had been out of school a couple of years, you know. So I just went up there, and I was a big Mingus fan. So I went to him. I said, "Mr. Mingus, could I please sit in?" And he said, "It's okay with me." He says, "But you got to ask George." And I thought to myself, wow, that's pretty respectful. You know, George is a saxophone player,
right.
So that I had to go through George.
Yeah.
So I went to George.
Which George was it?
George Adams.
George Adams.
So I said, "Mr. Adams."
Yeah.
Mr. Mingus said it would be all right if I sit, as long as it's okay with you. George said, "All right, come on." George became, later when I got to New York, he and I became good friends too. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I'm playing. So I was thinking Charles Mingus would play a blues or rhythm or something, you know, like easy like that. This is a lesson I learned. I'll tell you the lesson is. Anyway, he called one of his songs that the music expanded three music stands. That's what he called. I had to sight read the music. So I did, and George was very helpful. He could have not been. Right. He didn't have to be. And he just said, okay, we're going here now, and you know, like that. So I made it through reading the music. Then I did my solo and everything and all that and everything. Afterwards, but I didn't mess up his music, because you know Mingus had a reputation for if you messed up his music, he'd stop, embarrass you, say you paid your money to see professionals, and he says, but clearly the trumpet player doesn't believe in that, or whoever he was ragging on, he would just completely call you out if you messed up his music. So I made it through without messing up his music, and then on my way out, this is the last song, he let me sit in on the last song, so I was leaving. I went to him and he was sitting over, and I said, "Thank you, Mr. Mingus, for allowing me to sit." And he said, "Hey," he said, "you should come to New York." I said, "Yeah." He said, "Yeah." He says, "We play at Boomers." It was a club called Boomers here. He said, "We play at Boomers every Saturday. You should come. Come look me up." So he gave me the courage, or the feeling that I could come to New York. And so that was the first time.
Wow.
But that's when my father told me, he said, "You never go on anybody's stage unless you know their music." So that was one of my first lessons,
I mean, luckily you had the chops to get through it.
Yeah, but that was the point. He said, "Why should he change his program for you?"
Right.
You know, because I was used to the jam sessions and stuff, and I thought, but that was a good lesson.
Wow. And so you played in that band, in his band, for a little while, or you get?
Well, no, I actually after that I never got to play in his band.
Oh, okay.
Because I didn't go to New York right away.
Oh, okay.
My trip to New York came a different way.
Okay.
So I ended up playing with Cecil McBee, and then Elvin and Sun Ra. My trip went there. Sam Rivers, Elvin, and then later, and then Jack DeJohnette, and then McCoy.
Right. Wow, you've always gotten to play with the best drummers.
Oh yeah, I love drums. So that was my Uncle Brush. You know, he was a drummer. And he was also a Tuskegee Airman, so, you know, this him and Percy Heath served on in the same squadron. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Right, and your dad was in the Army bands.
He was in Navy band with Clark Terry. And.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's all there. Man.
Chaka Khan, you know.
Yeah?
Yeah. You know, on my block.
Oh, wow.
Richard Davis lived across the street. You know, Richard Davis, the bass player.
Yeah.
And I saw my friend, we grew up together on the street, Frank Leslie. His auntie was Abby Lincoln.
Wow.
So I used to see Abby Lincoln come visiting, you know, the family often.
Yeah, you know, she's someone who I think people are more and more coming around to realizing how important she was.
Yeah.
And one thing about her was that her late albums were as good as anything she ever did. I mean,
yeah,
she was
great.
Great songs.
I was in love with her, man. I was in love with her when she did the movie For Love of Ivy with Sidney Poitier.
Oh, okay.
I was like,
never came to fruition, huh?
Oh, no. Well, it could have maybe one day, but anyway,
all right.
She got there.
I mean, we hit. I mean, the Bobby Hutcherson, that was a big thing
yeah.
for you, and you have a project based on him,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, I'm going to, at Dizzy's, I'm going to mention, because of this year of him passing. I mean, everybody's doing tributes and things. But I just want to do personal tribute to him, so I'm going to do that at Dizzy's, yeah.
And you're writing new music?
Well, some music that he and I recorded together and some music that we played together and that we have in common together. Just
right.
to, yeah. One of the facts is he and I would play with McCoy and together. And I played with him once with Andrew Hill and Freddie Hubbard and some stuff. So that was... You know,
so these old school guys, did they... Like, I've interviewed Randy Weston and McCoy and like... Randy would say, "Oh, back in the days, we didn't speak much. We hung out, but we didn't talk." Because I'd be like, "Well, what did Max Roach say?" And he'd be like, "We didn't talk. We So was there like this code with the older generation where they were like, of less just?
Well, you had to earn your way. You had to be. It wasn't like they just grabbed you and became your mentor and started teaching you. It wasn't like that. You had to come in. You know, it's like you're a rookie.
Mm-hmm.
And then the guy, what I would say is this. Today, with the schools and everything, mm-hmm. young musicians, they get a lot of attention by teachers. You know, I mean, that's
right.
the whole point. But the school, the university of the street, so to speak, back then, was different. And you learned. But you learn by apprentice, sort of an apprenticeship type of thing. You could ask a question and they would tell you if you asked or, things like that. But you had, and the thing is, you didn't get respect by sounding like someone else.
Mm.
See, the difference, that sort of changed here in America. But, we have this race problem in America. Back then it was much stronger. So, black musicians didn't go around sounding like other musicians. The white musicians back then that sounded like, the only people that could get ahead sounding like or copying someone else were not black people.
Right.
Elvis Presley got where he got because he was the first white boy to sound as close as they had at that time to a black artist.
And it wasn't even that close?
Yeah, but the players who became Coltrane clones, the ones that really sounded like John Coltrane, weren't black players, and you never saw a black player get anywhere sounding like another great player.
Wow, I never put that together.
Yeah, I mean, Stan Getz was a great player, but he sounded a lot like Lester Young.
Right.
You see, and this is the thing. And one of the things is not in our culture, the black culture. This is not desirable.
Mm-hmm.
Wayne Shorter, if you ever hear Wayne Shorter talk, when he's something. The first thing is about your sound. You have to have your own sound. My dad always said. He says, "You got two ways to go, son." He says, "You can copy, which is easy." Or you can try to be an original, which is difficult, he said. And I said, why? He said, because if as an original, you may not be accepted. People may not be able to hear what you're doing. He went a long time before people understood. He's had his own voice for a very long time. Now he's revered. Well, musicians always revered him, but before the public really understood it. Now he's royalty in Chicago. But it took time, and it was difficult. And that's what he was telling me. But so if you look at all the great African-American players, they don't sound like Lester Young, doesn't sound like Coleman Hawkins, doesn't sound like Ben Webster, doesn't sound like Sonny Rollins doesn't sound like John Coltrane, right. Doesn't sound like Wayne Shorter, and so on and so on. Charlie Parker doesn't sound like Eric Dolphy, doesn't sound, you know, I mean, just, it's always about your individual voice. And that's part of what we do in the community on everything. Michael Jordan, the closest person you could look at Michael Jordan to would maybe be Dr. J, but not the same. If it's always about that individual voice, and you know, from Ray Charles to Stevie Wonder to from Muhammad Ali, Sugar Ray Robinson was maybe the closest person to Muhammad Ali in terms of boxing was Sugar Ray Robinson. How far apart they were, but Joe Louis and Jack Johnson, you know, compared to Muhammad Ali or Mike Tyson, you know, different. And that's part of what we respect. That's part of what you won't gain respect by sounding like someone else.
So when did you feel like you found your voice? Like,
I'm still looking for it. I think we always said you don't. You find it maybe some after you're gone.
Right.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I have it, but I'm still developing it, and it just, you know, it's still.
Yeah. So what are you working on these days, like musically? Like,
oh, I'm working on a lot of things. It's kind of there are a few things that I'm really seriously working on. I had spent a long time working on melodic. I wanted to develop my melodic sense in a different way. That's why this album, Spoken Into Existence, is very melodic, more melodic than people had been used to hearing me play in previous albums, you know. The other albums were more, I was experimenting with forms and rhythms and things like that. Then I need to work on my melody. So now I'm a couple of things.
Yeah.
You'll hear when they come out.
All right. Yeah. Well, we'll hear it. Dizzy's awesome. Well, thanks for your time. This is really great to learn from the masters. So appreciate it.
I appreciate it too. Thank you.